So a lot of us get really involved in electing representatives. Every 2, 4, 6 years, we say we need to figure out who these representatives are. We talk big principles and things like that. But once we vote, do we just walk away and that's the end of it?
The Family Freedom Podcast, voices of family and freedom. Now here's your host, Wendy Hart.
I am joined today by John Dougal, Utah's state auditor and legislator for 10 years, was it? 10 years?
A decade here for the area.
Awesome. And we're going to talk a little bit about the legislative process. So, John, once people elect their representatives, is that good enough? And then talk principles every couple of years and walk away? And
no, that is not enough. That is not enough. First, as a legislator, stuff is flowing fast and furious. There's all sorts of issues, all sorts of topics you're not necessarily an expert on. You're trying to understand that. And as a legislator, I would oftentimes reach out to folks that I knew had a good understanding on different topics. But clearly, if I don't know them, I'm much less likely to reach out to them. So you want to be there. You want your legislator to know who you are and what issues you care about so they can pick up the phone, shoot you an email, other things like that to get your insight.
Excellent. So how do they get to know their legislator? What's the best way?
Well, the best way is to help them on their campaign as they get elected, because clearly that helps them in that process. Mm-hmm. And mutually you've worked together on an issue that's important clearly to that legislator. Right. Outside of that, you know, town hall meetings, other things like that, helping out with different community events that the legislator's hosting, all those types of things help and build that relationship and that friendship.
Excellent. So Utah has a part-time legislature. It's 45 days.
Yes, it starts on the fourth Monday of January, runs 45 calendar days, excluding federal holidays.
Okay.
So technically it's 46 calendar days, but...
Because we got President's Day.
Because we have Washington and Lincoln Day.
Oh, that's right. Utah is different. And that's not true for every state. There are states that I think California has like a full-time legislature, and some states it's, you know.
So I tell lots of folks, one, Utah has a fixed start date. And most states, my understanding is they have a fixed start date. But Utah also has a fixed end date, so which is really important. I don't think you should have a legislature that's open-ended that can just kick things down the curb and drag things out. I was told one year, Oregon met for 283 days.
That's not part-time.
I don't know how you keep a job and quote-unquote work for 283 days.
Exactly. So the idea behind a part-time legislature is that you're not so removed from the people because you have to have a real job. Is that kind of the thought process?
You have to have a real job, real life. You have to live with the laws that you pass. Folks would talk to me. My wife used to joke because I'd go to the grocery store on Saturday nights and I'd spend 3 or 4 hours at the grocery store visiting with folks in the community.
So you go to the grocery store to get to know your
representative, at least if you were me, because I'd run those Saturday evening errands. And this was a place where lots of folks could see me. Okay. If you send somebody back to DC, or no matter how much you try and stay in touch with them, you're not going to accidentally just kind of run into them typically if they're spending most of their time in DC. And so that's one of those key things. Most people don't understand how available, how accessible their legislators are.
So let's say, you know, the average person may or may not know who their representative is. How do they get to know them? Other, you know, at this point, the legislature's in session. So how do I get to know my legislator and how do I interact with them if I haven't had previous experience?
If you have no idea who your legislator is, I'd recommend going to the legislative website, so le.utah.gov, and start to look there. I haven't looked recently, but there used to be a feature where you could type in your address, and it would tell you who your representative is and who your senator is. So that's a good way to start to find out who represents you. Mm-hmm. And then start reaching out to them, looking for, you know, town hall meetings that they're hosting, Facebook, other things like that. Most are, you know, trying to get folks to show up at those. And that's a way to start to then go sit in and listen and try and understand what the issues they're facing. Oftentimes, Chamber of Commerce's or other folks like that. Intermountain Healthcare oftentimes will host different events for legislators around the, especially around the valley where I've been. And so you start to go there and you listen. But one of the key things I tell folks is you want to start off helping them understand the issues that you have. Typically, if you approach a legislator and say, you're a moron, how stupid can you be? This is not a way to engender support in whatever cause that you're pushing, no matter how worthy it might be.
Right. Well, I think sometimes people think that, well, first of all, we get the impression that legislators have all the background information that we have, especially if it's an issue that we're involved with very deeply. And then somehow, I don't know if this is because of media, but we tend to not think of our representatives as humans, that they're somehow, that they don't have feelings and families. And so how do we see legislators as just normal people that put their shoes on and tie them the same way as everybody else?
They're just like each one of us. They saw issues in their community that they were concerned with, and that's why they stepped up to run. Ask yourself what keeps you from running as an individual. And many folks, they don't want people calling them names. They don't want derogatory comments, effort, and other things like that. But understand, they were willing to step into that ring, but they're just like you and I. You know, like you said, they have families. Typically, the legislator has maybe a little thicker skin just because of being part of the process.
That
develops over time, but their spouse and their kids haven't necessarily built up that same thicker skin. And so typically it hurts the family more than it may hurt the legislator in terms of people being upset with them, and their families see the amount of time that they sacrifice working to represent their community. And there's always going to be somebody upset about some issue, and that's just the nature of how it is. But my experience is most legislators are well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
They just may not come from the perspective that you've experienced. And so it's really critical to share your experience and your perspective so they can learn rather than just assuming that they don't know or they don't care.
That they're motivated by, they're just evil. They just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we look at recently the tax reform or tax restructuring that Utah went through,
mm-hmm.
and the referendum process and the legislature announcing that they're going to repeal it. And I can't tell you how many folks I heard say, well, legislators are lying to us. And I don't think most legislators are lying.
Right.
Oftentimes there are very complex issues, and there's few issues as complex as taxes or few things that drive people's passion as much as taxes. And so then I'd hear sometimes legislators misspeak or take one data point and extrapolate it to a different one that maybe wasn't a good comparison. But they weren't lying. They were just made a mistake or didn't fully understand the nature of what it was in the bill.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, on folks on the other side, too often, they didn't fully understand things that were in the bill as well.
Right. Well, and when you have a large bill, you're talking a lot of different points. So you might understand a particular section of it, but not have followed some of the other complexities somewhere else. And that's from both sides, right? The people as well as the legislators.
Absolutely. And just because there's something in the bill, it may affect something that's outside the bill that you didn't understand it was affecting outside the bill. Because you looked at the bill and the bill looked fine. It looked okay. Not knowing this unintended consequence over here.
Mm-hmm. And so in a way, that's why, you know, I've heard people say things like, well, we're getting to a point where we can have a direct democracy where people can just weigh in on things. As opposed to the way that our system was set up is a representative republic. We elect representatives. And so why is representation a better deal than my going through and looking at all the bills and voting the way that I think is best?
So there's a couple of key things there. One, legislators typically pass about 500 bills, probably consider about 800 bills on different topics. And when I was a brand new legislator, my day would start about 5 a.m. and run till about midnight, 6 days a week.
For 46 days?
Yes, for the entire session. And most folks just do not have that much time to be able to put into the legislative process every year. I'm going to set aside 7 weeks every year to do all this research. And so therefore, we elect folks to do a bunch of research on our behalf. And we hope they have good principles and a good basis for the community. But then you also have this interesting dynamic at when is a legislator supposed to vote for what they believe is in our best long-term interest, even though maybe we don't fully understand that. Mm-hmm. And you get into this interesting conflict there where we think we understand it, but we don't fully understand the nuances there. And so then we're condemning them, even though they're trying to address concerns.
The bigger issue.
The bigger issue. And you've heard, many folks will remember back during the Obama administration, the term never let a crisis go to waste.
Right.
And it's this interesting dynamic in the legislative process. The public, when you're trying to avoid a crisis and you're trying to address long-term issues, but it's taking the public out of their comfort zone, but you're trying to avoid that crisis, too often they don't want that. And we like to live in this comfort zone. And then it becomes a crisis, and then it compels change. And so sometimes we unfortunately punish elected officials who are trying to address long-term issues for our own short-term comfort.
Well, we like what we're familiar with.
Absolutely. We like what we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about lobbyists. You know, there are organizations, companies that pay people specifically to go up and lobby the legislature. And so how is that important? And as a regular citizen, you know, we don't have a neighborhood lobbyist that goes up and advocates for our neighborhood. Arguably, that's what our representative is supposed to be, right? But tell me about lobbyists and how do we either help or hurt or what? Because I think lobbyists get a bad rap sometimes, but sometimes it's probably
well deserved in some cases. So I would break lobbyists into a couple different categories. One, there is a lobbyist for a company, and all they do is represent interests and concerns of that company. Mm-hmm. One type of lobbyist. You have other lobbyists that I would call contract lobbyists, and they represent multiple companies or multiple industries, and they're on contract. And so they represent an array of different interests. And so sometimes it's harder to understand what their interests might be, what company they're representing, in which case, and other things like that. But I would call those the contract lobbyists versus, if you will, the company lobbyists. And then you will have folks that are more what I would call volunteer lobbyists or citizen lobbyists. So they're not necessarily paid to lobby, but they're passionate representing a certain group, association, or community, and they're going up there spending their time and effort to lobby. And so there's different flavors of lobbyists, and I've worked with all of them. The key thing is lobbyists are critical in the process because they're bringing information to legislators, information they may not be aware of, to better help them understand as they try and make a decision, what impacts is it going to have, whether intended or unintended or other things like that. I mean, I don't work in the healthcare industry, and so you would have various lobbyists from the healthcare industry advocating for or against different pieces of legislation, trying to educate me on what are the issues that I should be aware of. And so that was critical in that process. Now, where I saw a lot of value from lobbyists is I would have them say, and what is the opposition going to say? If they could articulate more effectively what the opposition was going to say, yet in an accurate manner, then I could rely much better on those lobbyists because I considered them being fair because they were able to articulate both sides or the array of concerns that are out there versus someone who would try and spin their story.
Straw man
argument. And not really be straight up about what the other issues are, what the other side might say about it. Mm-hmm. And the simple fact is, if a lobbyist has an interest to represent their clients, but they also have an interest to build a long-term relationship so they can be a resource of information that a legislator can rely on and can trust. If I had a lobbyist who I knew I couldn't trust him, there's no reason for me to ask him for any information because I can't trust what they say. And therefore, whatever, if you will, they're pitching, it's of no benefit to me because I can't rely on it. Mm-hmm. It's not useful for making a decision.
That's very insightful. Because
But we have this concept that, oh, they're slimy, they're horrible, whatever. But they're really just resources of information.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you were saying at the beginning that, you know, how do we expect an average person to address all of those issues of the 500 or 800 bills and that you would reach out to individuals? So that brings us back to why you need to be a resource as an individual to your legislator if you have a benefit of experience. Is that?
Oh, it's critical because each person is going to bring certain expertise, mm-hmm. certain interests, certain passions, a certain set of information that's going to help that legislator in the decision-making process. And so being able to be somebody that that legislator can turn to say, tell me about this education-related bill and education policy, or tell me about these transportation issues we're dealing with, or tell me about clean air policies and what do you see that's effective and what works and what doesn't work. You can then be a valuable resource for those legislators, and not just your own legislator, but other legislators around the state. There's a simple set of rules that legislators learn early in the process, and that is called, first one is 38, 15, and 1. Wendy, do you know what that means?
I think that has to do with how many people it takes to pass a bill.
That's right. Think back to those early morning cartoons of how a bill becomes a law. And in Utah, 38 votes is the majority in the House out of 75. So you have to have 38 votes in the House to pass a bill. In the Senate, you have 29 senators, so a majority is 15. So you have to have at least 15 senators agree to that bill, and then one being the governor. So 38, 15, and 1 is the rule that you learn, right? First day. Mm-hmm. And you try and learn how to count to see if you have those votes. The second rule that you learn is called 50 and 20. So if you need to override a governor's veto, you need at least 50 votes in the House, 2/3, and at least 20 votes in the Senate, also 2/3, to override a governor's veto. Now, here's one of the things that you're always told, and I had concerns with. Basically, you were told, as long as you have those votes, you can do anything you want to. And too often, we precondition the public to think might makes right. Mm-hmm. And they forget what the principles are of defending liberty. But yes, those are the basic fundamental rules of the legislative process.
So what are the limitations on the legislature, broadly speaking?
Well, I mean, there's certain bounds on the legislature in terms of the Constitution. If the legislature wants to amend the Constitution, it takes two-thirds vote of the House and the Senate and then has to go out to a majority of the public. So the Utah Constitution places a certain bound on the legislature. The U.S. Constitution, in theory, also places a bound, but we see how folks seem to run roughshod over whatever is in the U.S. Constitution and how the courts over the years have seemed to expand what it really means. And the box and the limits on the U.S. Constitution don't seem to be there as you and I would probably expect them to be.
Yeah.
But even then, I come from the perspective where I want limited government to protect my rights and then leave people free to govern themselves. But this is where lots of other folks want you and I to do certain things or pay certain bills or fund certain programs. And so therefore, they will use the legislative process to say, hey, as long as I can get 38, 15, and 1, then we're going to put in place this program and it's going to do these things. And by definition, it's good because I got the legislature to pass it.
Interesting. So really fast.
And it takes the same votes to pass a bill to put a program in place as it does to repeal a program and get rid of it.
So that it's the same process. You have to still pass a bill to say, we don't want to do this.
I wanted to get rid of the vehicle inspection program. So I still had to get 38, 15, and 1 to work to undo that program. And I couldn't get the votes to undo it. So I got the votes to pare back some of the inspections. And then 5 years later, Dan McKay, Representative McKay at the time, ran the bill to repeal the program.
Pull it back. But it's still legislation, even if it's not.
It's still running a bill. And this is where some folks say, can't believe they did that many bills. Well, to repeal a program, you have to run a bill.
You have to run a bill. So give me a brief overview. You got a House and you got a Senate. Why do we have two and how does that work? I'm just a bill cartoon. How does that work?
So in the House, I mentioned there's 75 members. So they are smaller districts, represent about 36 to 40,000 people. They are supposed to be closer to the people. They are up for election every 2 years. And so the slogan or motto, if you will, of the House is Vox Populi, voice of the people. And that is what the House is really supposed to be. It's supposed to be more in tune with the passions of the electorate. The Senate has a four-year term. There's 29, so they're fewer. They're bigger districts. Their term is 4 years, but it's a staggered 4 years. So half are up one term, and 2 years later, essentially the other half are up. And it's supposed to be a little more deliberative, a little more of a calming influence, a tempering influence in that process. So you get the passions of the electorate tempered to try and make sure it's good policy. So you're trying to get things through both bodies. And then that's where, in theory, the governor is supposed to be a check on the legislature in terms of the good policy getting passed. Now, sometimes we see the governor being more the whip driving the legislature, but I think ideally the governor, as the term governor means, is to put a limit on that to make sure that only good legislation passes and blocks bad legislation. So that's kind of the dynamic that we have. And most states have two chambers in the legislative body. I think it's Nebraska has only a single unicameral. Mm-hmm. And you will see, and this is one of the inside secrets of the legislative process, especially here in Utah, sometimes really hard to tell one of your colleagues. For example, when I served in the House, no. So lots of House members will vote for bills that they don't really support because it's hard to tell their friend no. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go over to the Senate to work the Senate to make sure the Senate kills the bill. Because it's easier when some members of the other House kill a bill of somebody in your chamber and stuff. The other interesting dynamic is you may vehemently oppose a bill that somebody runs, but you may need them on another bill because there are so many votes that are taking place. If you make enemies with everybody, you're never going to get anything done. You always have to have 38, 15, and 1. And if you ostracize everybody, even if you want to repeal the most horrid piece of legislation
that everyone agrees on,
that quote unquote everybody agrees on, but if you can't get their support because you ostracize yourself, then you just did a disservice to your constituents. So you always have that challenge of how do you teach good governance, good principles, while helping build this coalition to get good legislation done, whether that's putting something in place or getting rid of something that exists. And that is a challenge because it's easy to tell people no and burn bridges, but you need their vote time after time, day after day, throughout the entire session. and this is why I had folks ask me, why do you get along so well with the Democrats when they oppose you on everything you do? But I thought it was important for me to work with them to try and help them understand my constituency and how they saw the world and why that was important. And they clearly were advocating on behalf of their constituency. And let's be blunt. I live in the Alpine Highland American Fork area. Okay. My constituents see the world very differently than Representative King, who represents part of Salt Lake City, Sugar House. Mm-hmm. They just see the world differently. They expect different things from the government, and that is part of the process.
And that's why we have representatives from different areas, arguably so that when you come together, those different voices are out there, and mm-hmm. and at least the ideas are debated and discussed, and it's not just all one voice. So run me through, let's say you have a bill, how do you have a great idea. How do you get it started and go through? And
so if you have an idea for a bill, you can either work with one of your legislators, your senator, your representative, or maybe some other legislator who really agrees, doesn't even have to represent your area, but agrees with the issue. Mm-hmm. They will contact legislative staff to open what's called a bill file. Okay. And then the amendments to statute will go into that bill file. And as soon as that bill file is ready, it will be what's called numbered. So an official number will be put on it. So if it's a House bill, maybe it's House Bill 123, and it's an issue on education, let's say. But then that bill, once numbered, goes off to get what's called a fiscal note, and the fiscal analysts will now estimate what it costs or what savings will be reaped as a result of that bill. And once that happens, it will come through the process. And so it goes to, in this case, the House, and the House will assign it to the House Rules Committee, and the House Rules Committee will then sort the bills and sift the bills and determine which committee it wants to send the bill to. So maybe in this case, it's going to send it to the Education Standing Committee because it deals with education policy. And then you will have a hearing in that Education Committee for the House. If you can get enough support in committee, they will vote out the bill favorably to the House floor. Maybe they will amend the bill in committee. Maybe they will kill your bill in committee. But if you can get it out of House committee, it now goes to the House floor. And then you wait on the calendar until it's your turn to present your bill. And then they will debate the bill and then vote on the bill. And if you can get at least 38 votes for the typical bill, then you can pass out of the House and go over to the Senate. Senate will then send the bill off to Senate Rules Committee. It will get sifted. It will get sent to a Senate committee. And it will go through the same process in the Senate. Now, if the Senate passes the exact same bill as the House, then it will return to the House, where it will be signed and sent to legislative staff for enrolling or for preparing for the governor to review and consider signing the bill. And then after that, it will get enrolled. If the Senate amends the House bill, then the bill has to come back to the House for the House to consider whether or not they want to accept the amendments of the Senate, the wisdom of the Senate, as the senators might say, or not. And they can either accept it, and then that bill needs to go off to the governor for his approval typically, or you'll go send it back to the Senate and ask the Senate to recede or back down from their amendments. Sometimes the Senate will back down or vice versa in the House, depending which way the bill's going, and then it will pass that way. If the House and the Senate can't agree, then you will typically get assigned to what's called a conference committee, or three House members and three senators will try and hammer out the issues on the bill and try and come to a compromise. And the committee may come to a compromise, and the House and the Senate both agree with the compromise, and away you go, and the bill passes.
Or they may not.
Or they may not. And I've seen cases where conference committee was assigned, and the conference committee failed, and another conference committee was assigned, and it failed, another one was assigned, and it failed. Or they may have agreed and sent it off to their respective bodies, and the respective bodies rejected it, and they had to form, you know, different conference committees to try and find some way to bridge the divide between the House and Senate. Sometimes they can bridge the divide, and sometimes they can't, and if it can't, then the bill dies. The other dynamic is at the end of the session, if that bill does not pass by midnight on the last night of the session, then the bill is dead.
And then you have to wait a year.
And then you have to wait either for a special session or wait till the next year to reopen a bill.
It's actually a fairly involved process to pass a law.
It is very involved. In fact, I tell folks there's typically one way to pass a bill, that 38-15-1. And there's thousands of ways to kill a bill. Okay. You can amend a bill to death. And you can slow roll a bill through the process. So it just takes so much time that it runs out of time by the time it gets there. And you can do all sorts of other things in terms of just dragging out that bill to delay it and kill it. And sometimes you just straight up kill the bill in committee, on the floor, other things like that. But even when a bill is supposedly dead, it's typically not dead if there's a power to bring it back and stuff. And so that's one of the key things, is to always watch. Is if you don't do what's called striking the enacting clause, and technically the bill's still alive. Oftentimes it's dead just because it doesn't have support. Mm-hmm. But I have seen bills that we have shot down in committee, voted down in committee, that still came up on the House floor in the final days of the session. And most of my colleagues are going, I thought we killed the bill. Well, we voted it down in committee. It didn't get accepted by the committee. It didn't get forwarded to the House floor, but there's still other routes for it to get there. And there's lots of rules, and there's rules of how to lift a bill out of one committee, move it to another committee, all sorts of other things like this. And after you learn the rules of what it takes to pass a bill, you also learn that for most things, not those votes, but for most other things, you can suspend the rules. And so there are ways to say, these are the rules in process. But if you get enough folks, let's say 2/3, to agree with you, then you can suspend the rules and you can do something different.
Sounds complicated.
It is. It is a complicated process. And You can learn lots as you watch that process and learn. And if you master the rules, you can become more effective as a legislator. I remember having a bill one time, and it was slated to come out at the bottom of the House calendar. And it probably would have died just because we were late in the session. But I was able to get it put at the top of the House calendar, which meant immediately it was the next bill we would consider. And so it was expedited in this process. And a whole bunch of folks that were trying to kill the bill were then stunned with how quickly the bill came out at the top of the calendar.
Well, thank you for your time. I'm excited to watch this legislative session and see how we can be more involved. What's exciting to me is that people, I think, can decide to be as involved as they want to be, pick an issue that they are interested in, or get to know their legislator, as you mentioned, to help facilitate that acquisition of knowledge.
Yeah, don't kill yourself on trying to master all 500 bills. Start with a limited number that are really of interest to you, and start teaching the principles that also matter. And understand that legislators are looking for solutions. It's one thing to say there's a problem. It's another thing to help them find a solution.
A solution. Don't just complain, but come up with an idea.
Right. Perfect. And understand that there's limited time. So oftentimes I tell folks, when they send an email to a legislator, be clear, put your contact information in there, your address, your phone number, so they know you're actually a constituent of theirs. Mm-hmm. They can pick up the phone and call you if they want to. And then keep your message to point. A brief email articulating your concern and your recommendation, meaningful recommendation, is much more valuable than a long-term treatise that either berates them or just goes into minutiae that they don't have time to research at the time.
Thank you.
Certainly.
This has been the Family Freedom Podcast with Wendy Hart. Follow this podcast, share with your friends and neighbors, and add to the voices of family and freedom.